Studio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write on Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On Magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio interviews, inspiring you to write by sharing the experience of prominent authors. Our interview this month is with novelist Lavi Tidar. Working across several genres, including science fiction and fantasy, Tidar won the 2012 World Fantasy Award for his novel Osama and the Gerwood Fiction Uncovered Prize for A Man Lies Dreaming. Born in Israel, he has lived in the UK and South Africa. The interviewer is Palak Tiwari, who was alongside Write On editor Madeline White.
I do not read sci-fi as a norm, generally, but I found your book to be very, not just sci-fi. There was a lot of adventure in it, and it went, you know, there was a lot of travel and like different places. I think it's banned so many years. So I would love to know what you think, where sci-fi sits in today's world.
Well, you know, it's such a weird thing for me because I wear so many hats that I kind of have to. It depends which hat I'm wearing to answer the question in a way. Because weirdly enough, the books I've got coming out in the UK are mainstream fiction, are literary fiction. So I'm finding myself in this weird position where I'm wearing one hat for being a serious author, doing strictly realist fiction, and then I wear another hat where I'm crazy, you know, I come up with this crazy stuff, and then I wear another hat occasionally where suddenly I'm an expert on artificial intelligence, which I think is mostly because no one is an expert on artificial intelligence, so it's very easy to be one. You know, I think The Circumference of the World is less a science fiction book and more a book about science fiction, which I don't know if it makes it any better. But it's a novel that kind of encompasses a bunch of different genres and different approaches to writing. And I think that was part of the fun of writing it, is that I got to write in very different voices.
And how do you distinguish between the different genres? Do you think that, okay, this is what's going to be the genre that I'm writing now and focus on that? Or do you just mix it up? How do you focus, I mean, distinguish between the different genres that you do?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm very interested in structure, which I think what genre is a lot of the time is structure. You know, if we have a detective story, we have certain expectations from the detective story. You know, we expect there to be a detective. We expect there to be either something missing or someone turn up dead. And we expect there to be a mystery, and we expect the mystery to be solved. So it immediately provides a structure for a story. And one of the fun thing is then to say, what can I do with this structure? How can I play with it? While still, and I think that's kind of an important thing, you still have to be faithful to the structure, even if you're going to mess around with it. And I think I had that with a book called Unholy Land, which I like a great deal. But it's a book that uses the structure of the detective story in order to explore politics and alternate histories and actual histories and so on. So it's very much sort of a skeleton for the book, that there's a guy who's looking for something. In this case, he was looking for his niece who went missing. And when I wrote a synopsis of the book and I sent it to my editor at the time, she came back to me and she said, this all sounds very well, but what happened to the niece? And I said, what do you mean? And I completely forgot that he was looking for his missing niece, that the whole engine of the story was that he was looking for her, because it wasn't important to me. This was just a skeleton. So I obviously had to then go back and play fair and make sure that he finds the niece at the end of the book, that mystery is resolved. So I'm very interested in structures and genres, but part of the fun is playing with them and not taking them too seriously.
In your book as well, I saw that it spanned from 1900s to, you know, 10,000 light years away and so forth. So it spans a huge period. Do you look at history to come up with your ideas? How do you frame them? Do you do a lot of research?
Well, the book starts in Vanuatu, where I actually lived. So that's all based on lived experience. So I got very interested in what happened in Vanuatu, which is a small group of islands in the South Pacific. What happened in World War II, where American forces basically showed up out of nowhere, you can imagine it, and then took over the islands for a bit and built air bases. And then the island where I was living on, which is very remote and near the Solomon Islands, they had a group of soldiers stationed up on a hill, kind of watching for Japanese submarines and attack planes. And you could still go there. And I went up there one day. Someone took me up there. And you could still see the base where they were. You could see their old wine bottles and bullets. And, you know, they just left this stuff behind. So I thought that was really interesting real-life story. And I got some, you know, I actually spoke to people who were still alive during the war as kids and remembered it. And things like a Japanese submarine being attacked by American planes and then washing the debris washing up onto the shore. You know, so I kind of got to incorporate a lot of stuff firsthand. And these weren't necessarily the nicest characters, you know, in hindsight. But there was an innocence to the people who were writing science fiction in America in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And I got really interested in them. A lot of them wrote books about it. Or there's even a book, you know, there's books where these people appear under sort of different names, like Romana Clef. So I read a lot about them in their own words, in other people's words, and that became another part of the book. And then another part of the book is simply sort of a love letter to this vanished landscape of London 20 years ago when it was full of bookshops. You know, and it was full of book dealers and bookshops, and it was a really, and they're all gone, and it's really strange to realize. I think I only realized that was writing it, that this world doesn't exist anymore, that this is sort of like a nostalgic look at a world that is never going to come back again.
Vanuatu is obviously absolute prime in terms of cli-fi, because Vanuatu is one of the sinking islands. And in terms of writer responsibility, did that influence you at all?
I mean, not for this book, because this book isn't prominently concerned with climate change. The group of islands in Vanuatu, the Torres Islands, which are the furthermost islands and the most remote islands, and I spent a week going around there in a small boat. And those islands are low-lying islands, so they are, slowly being engulfed by the sea. And that's definitely something that started coming into my science fiction works after a while, that I did feel the need I needed to write about, you know, climate change and so on. The problem is, though, I think a lot of people at the moment are writing about climate change, and I think a lot of people at the moment are writing sort of dystopian fiction.
Yeah.
You know, science fiction is dystopia. And what I've realized is that I'd rather write stories that are hopeful about the future. One thing is they're more fun to write, to be honest.
Yeah.
But the other thing, it's about giving people hope. And I found that when I did a book called Central Station, that really resonated with people, because it was about the future where we didn't destroy the world, we didn't destroy ourselves, we did get to get all the cool sci-fi stuff. And I wasn't thinking in terms of I want to make people feel better. I was thinking in terms of I want to play with these cool toys, and I can't do that if the world has been, you know, destroyed. But that it really did have an impact on me in terms of my thinking, because I realized that that is something that we don't have too much of, and is a positive thing to do. You know, and it's the thing about the Great Barrier Reef, that if you know, it's not dead yet, but when you say the Great Barrier Reef is dead, you're stopping any opportunity of bringing it back, of rehabilitating it, of making, because people are just going to go, well, it's too late. There's nothing we can do, you know? So I think it's a tricky area to write about. And I also find if you're going to go into climate fiction, then you can either end up being very didactic very quickly or very boring very quickly. So there's some much better, there's some great books being written in that field at the moment. The Coral Bones, I think, is a recent one by E.J. Swift.
That's really interesting, because motivation and sort of positivity is one of the things that runs as a theme in the work that I do as well. And I find that having something to, anchor myself towards it makes it easier writing. Is there a theme that you feel, or hopefulness, is that you feel that runs through throughout your work?
No, I actually write some very, very dark books. I mean, I wrote a book called A Man Lies Dreaming, which is probably one of the darkest books. You know, it's about Adolf Hitler as a private detective in 1930s London. And it's an incredibly dark book, but very funny book, I think. You know, it's a funny, horribly dark book. But yeah, I think science fiction does offer that notion of not necessarily hope, but wonder. And I don't really like nihilistic science fiction. I don't like the idea we say the universe is meaningless, human life is meaningless, the universe is meaningless, we can do whatever we want because nothing makes any sense. And in fact, I think science fiction offers us the ability to look at the wider universe that we're in and to ask really fundamental questions. And that was almost a working title for one version of this book, was Fundamental Constants, which is the very small number of numbers that really control, you know, govern the universe we live in. Mm-hmm. And there's so much wonder and awe, I think, that you can have from contemplating things on a galactic scale. And in a way, you know, realist fiction, what we do in realist fiction is we focus so much on a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of the universe, which is our little lives on Earth. And we pretend that that's all there is. But in fact, we're just the tiniest part of this weird, strange, enormous universe filled with galaxies and black holes and dark matter and exotic particles. And this universe itself might only be a tiny bubble in a sea of universes that exists forever and forever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I love being able to ask the big questions. Why are we here? Is there a God? You know, what is the meaning of life? And I can't answer them because then I'll have my own religion, like the character in the book. Not like any real person that we can think of.
Well, saying that, as a Hindu, we believe that there are many universes and we are just one part of one universe, and there are many of those. There is some believers out there. So that some of these things that you just mentioned in there really resonated as well, which is quite interesting because that brings me, you're very international, like, you know, you've lived in several places, and in your books as well, I saw there was a tour around the world as well. Because I'm born in India, I grew up in Kenya, I've lived in the UK, I've traveled like 40 countries or so. There is this concept of like every person have their preconceived notions, they have different cultural backgrounds. Do you take that into your process at all?
Well, I mean, this is the weird thing where I find myself is a lot of my books are very heavily leaning on my background. And to the extent that I find it distracting occasionally, because I don't really want to be pigeonholed, you know, I don't want to be pigeonholed as an Israeli writer or as a Jewish writer or any of those categories that they want to put you into. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's kind of the nice thing about the circumference of the world, that it doesn't lean that heavily into my own background. Whereas books like A Man Lies Dreaming is about the Holocaust and Holy Land is about versions of Israel. And the literary fiction that I have coming out here in the UK is last year's Maror, which is out in paperback in August, I think. And the next one, Adama, which is about a kibbutz in Israel, a very dark sort of family saga and kind of really looks at, you know, 100 years of history and so on. So they kind of really lean heavily into it. And one of the nice things, again, about science fiction is that I get to take occasionally a step back. And in fact, you know, and the next book I'm doing, which is another literary fiction, it's another historical epic. I kind of said, I want to write a book that does not have me in it at all. I want to write about characters who are don't share anything with me at all, you know. And there's a certain relief in it, but I think you have to do one book that is very personal and maybe one book where you get to have a bit more fun. And also the other thing I find very enjoyable is writing about the English, because I find them, firstly, no one is ever going to complain if you make fun of the English. And you know, and I find that really interesting. So I have this series of very weird historical fantasies. One sort of deals with King Arthur and one sort of deals with Robin Hood, because I thought if you're going to aim for big targets, big obvious targets, you know. So a book called By Force Alone, which kind of sends up the whole notion of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And then a book about Robin Hood, which got very weird very fast. And there's a great, that's another strand. There's just a great joy in making fun out of sacred myth that people hold, I think.
Another thing I found about your writing was that there was a very poetic turn of words. And I believe you started your publication with a poetry collection as well. Is that your guilty pleasure?
It's more my tragedy that I was never good enough, you know. I mean, it's very easy to be a good science fiction writer. It's very hard to be an excellent poet. I was okay. I was good. I don't think my poetry is bad, but I could never be, you know, and when you read a poem that is a classic poem, you think there's no way I could do this. Well, what was the one I was thinking about recently? You know, The Emperor of Ice Cream, Wallace Stevens, which is, I could never, you know, it's impossible to write a poem as good as that. It's the poem where you go, why even try? You know, but I can make an adequate novelist. I can make a good novelist. So a lot of the time I actually try and smuggle poetry into the book. And I created an alter ego, not an alter ego, but I created this character as a joke called Lioti Roche, who shares my initials. And I only used him so I can quote my own poems in the books occasionally. And then he kind of took on a life of his own, and he got to star in this book called Unholy Land. And then everyone thought the character in the book was clearly me because of the initials and so on. When I actually wrote him as a parody of a friend of mine who is a successful poet, but also very, very neurotic and so on.
Lavi, how many languages do you speak?
Three, I guess. One of the fun things, well, when I lived in Vanuatu, I learned Bishlama, which is the sort of pidgin Creole language that's spoken on the islands, which I loved. And I used it, I actually turned it into the sort of the common tongue in my science fiction stories. So people, you know, people think I made the language up. I didn't make it. It's a real language. it just makes sense. And there was actually a British theatre director back in the 70s and 80s who also believed that this should be the universal language. And he put on 9-hour production of Hamlet in Bishlama in London, which apparently is pretty legendary. But what happened was I actually ended up writing fiction in Bishlama, which I think not many people do, and my friend was editing the local newspaper, the Vanuatu Daily Post. So he gave me a column, and I published for 1 year. I published 12 short stories in Bishlama, which one day I'd like to collect. But again, it's another one of those very strange little projects. But it was fun because, you know, it's always interesting to try doing something in a different language and the challenges and the uniqueness that comes with it. And I found that when I translate them back into English, they don't work quite as well because they are so specific for a place and a language. And
do you write in other languages as a given? So do you, you know, are you commissioned to write in other languages? And how does that change your writing?
No, I mean, I wrote in Hebrew. I wrote science fiction in Hebrew for a while, and I translated some of it back into English. And some of it was quite good, but I kind of gave up on it because there was no, you know, there's no audience. There was no, I'm not actually well known in Israel. I'm not really published in Israel. I've had a couple of books published in Israel, whereas I've had, you know, 6 books published in Japan. That kind of gives you the idea of how well I'm looked at. So I kind of gave up on it, and now I don't think I'd be able to write in Hebrew like I used to because I lost the muscles for it. But I find that when I write in English, I don't want to write standard English, you know, and I very much let the patterns of Hebrew work in. And, you know, and every time I deal with copy editors hate going over my books because they're not standard and they want to change them. I'm like, I don't want to change it. I want it to sound different. I'm fine with it. So, and Bishlama, weirdly enough, kind of had a similar structure to Hebrew than it had to English. So I think English speakers struggled with it, even though the vocabulary is 90% comes from English. Whereas I found it quite, you know, the rhythm was the same.
Is there any guilty pleasures that you have that, you know, you or even cliches or tropes that you secretly enjoy?
I love using the word suddenly, which I know it's like rule number one is don't use suddenly in a book, but I can't help myself. You know, it's the sort of word that every editor will go over the manuscript and say, can you delete all the suddenlies? But I like the suddenly. Oh, he said suddenly. Yeah, no, you know, I'm not perfect. I like what are they called? Adverbs, adjectives. What's the stuff that comes after said? You know, he said suddenly. You know, I know you shouldn't be using them, but occasionally they're really fun to use. But I try to keep dialogue very minimal. I like dialogue that is just dialogue, or at most, you know, someone said, and that's it. So I try to be dispersed, but I like to change things around. So I'm very good at writing noir for some reason, and hard boiled. I can actually do hard boiled fiction in my sleep, which is sort of scary. And my one popular thing that I ever did was I wrote Winnie the Pooh as a sort of hard boiled detective noir thing on Twitter. That's the only thing I'm known for. It had like 3 million views. And so that's ex eclipsed everything I've ever done, and that's only because I was bored one evening.
And to go back to the beginning when you started your journey, how did this genre come about? I know for me, like when I was young, I used to read a lot of Agatha Christie, and that sort of influenced a little bit of my work, you know, in terms of bringing in a human puzzle. And are there any sort of literary works or any authors that have influenced you, or why this genre?
I think any writer you read, you know, and some of them you don't even acknowledge because they're so much part of your DNA that you don't think about them. I mean, in fact, you know, Agatha Christie, I never thought I'd even be able to write Golden Age type puzzles, you know, and then it turned out during kind of just before lockdown, and I wrote a vampire mystery. I wrote an Agatha Christie vampire mystery short, you know, like a
Very interesting.
novelette. And I was like, this is the first and only time that I could ever write like a classical golden age, because it's even more difficult to do when you have vampires in it than just people. But it became, you know, the editor who bought it really liked it, and they kept commissioning me to do more. And it turns out that getting paid is a pretty good motivation. But I found myself, I really enjoyed the challenge of the golden age murder mystery, where it's formulaic. But that formula offers an almost endless array of possibilities, and it's also a lot of fun to do. But that's the only form of writing, I think, where I spend most of my time figuring everything out, and then the writing itself takes the least amount of time.
Oh, so you do a
Because
lot of prep work beforehand?
for a golden age murder mystery, which is a really specific type of writing. But then I love books where you can just make stuff up as you go along. I did a book during the second lockdown we had. I did a book called Neon, and it was purely just for me to kind of get a bit of, you know, a bit of an escape. And so I didn't know where it was going. I started with a single image, which was a robot holding a flower, and I didn't know why. I didn't know anything. And I wrote it throughout the lockdown, and it came out. It was sort of the book where you're just writing to find out what happens next, and you have no idea if it's actually gonna reach an ending. But it sort of worked, and that came out from Tachyon last year, I think. But that was sort of just purely for the fun of it. And so sometimes I will plan everything in advance very methodically, and sometimes I will just make it up as I go along. It's
Because you write so many genres, is there one that you're really passionate about?
A good question. I mean, I do have an affection for noir, like real noir fiction, which we don't see too much. And I'm trying to read a lot of international noir. I find that every country will have some authors who have been doing that. I'm reading a French one at the moment, which I find really interesting. It's sort of an absurdist noir book. And I've been reading, you know, Peruvian noir and there's some Polish noir, you know. So I find that really interesting, because at the best kind of noir is really about deconstructing society and kind of showing the corruption behind and the futility, and everyone is sort of doomed. And you know, they have to be short books. They can't be long, because they'll be too depressing otherwise. Everyone is doomed and it's terrible. But you know, they become very lyrical, I think.
I was just struck also in the book with this, you know, and you've touched on it in terms of this lost landscape and this landscape of nostalgia and bookshops. And I just wonder, I mean, I'm of a certain age, I'm in my 50s, you know, and I think all of us are nostalgic for some kind of landscape we leave behind. To what degree do bookshops and books make up that landscape of your life? And have you kind of dealt with that in some way through Circumference of the World? So I suppose it's a question about landscape and your reading and a combination of both as a kind of, you know, part of your journey.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think writing books kind of cured me of collecting books to an extent, because I just accumulate too many, you know, I have copies of my own books come in all the time and I have to just give them to charity shops most of the time. So it's cured me a little bit of it. But to me, there's nothing better than being in a secondhand bookshop. I particularly like secondhand bookshop. That smell of old paper, you know, which is really paper gently breaking down chemically, I think. But and libraries, which are still such a vital place, you know, one of the few public spaces we even have left as a society. So I go to my local library all the time. But I miss secondhand bookshops, and all my fond memories are from various secondhand bookshops around the world. And one of the things I loved when I came to London was that world of collectors. I still love collectors. I mean, every signing, if I do a signing, the only people who will ever show up are collectors. And I understand them, because we're the same, you know. So they show up and they'll have a stack of four proof copies of the same book, or they'll have that one limited edition that only there are only 100 copies of. And I will get exactly where they're coming from. So I'll always sign anything for anyone, because I know that feeling. What's it like to go and hunt for these things? And I think part of it is the hunt, you know, that you're hunting for a bargain, you're hunting for that rare book, and then you find and you get to brag about it, which is worth even more than actually having the book.
Do you find your work is heavily influenced by where you originate from in terms of some of the concepts you talk about?
Well, I mean, Central Station came about when I was living back in Israel for a while. So I became fascinated by the actual place, which is in South Tel Aviv, which is full of sort of refugees and migrant workers and so on. I thought that was such a fascinating area. But also, yeah, part of my thinking was no one has ever done a science fiction novel set in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
You know, and so I kind of like to introduce it as the best novel. The best science fiction novel set in Tel Aviv, but by default, it's also the worst science fiction novel set in Tel Aviv. So, you know, because it's the only one. No, I mean, my interest isn't to write political fiction in the sense of, do you vote Labour or Conservative? Do you vote, you know, that sort of stuff. It's more about talking about political processes and historical political processes and how we end up where we do. So A Man Lies Dreaming, which is my book about Hitler and the Holocaust and so on, was really prompted by coming back to the UK in 2011, having been away for 5 years. And just that sense of xenophobia and that sense of anger and that sense of nationalism that wasn't there when I left, and I could feel it, and I could feel it across Europe as well. And, you know, and I wrote the book before Trump, and I wrote the book before Brexit. And it's a very different experience reading the book after, because it almost seems to echo, and certainly the rhetoric that I have people use in the book echoes almost word for word stuff that Nigel Farage was saying or that Donald Trump was saying. And that was a bit of a shock, because I was kind of writing the book as a warning of, this is where we end up if this goes on. And then it went on. You know, yeah. And so you'd be reading the book now and thinking that it was written after all of that stuff. Yeah. But it's that sense of it, you know, which I think we still are in at the moment. But yeah, I don't want to write dogmatic books. I want to write books that kind of examine the wider spectrum of why people behave the way they do.
What else are we looking forward to from you?
So I've got the Circumference of the World, which is coming out in September. September also sees Adama, which is my big literary Israel set novel. It's about 100 years of Israeli. It's four generations of a very messed up family. And if you think Yellowstone, if you've seen Yellowstone, think Yellowstone in Palestine. That's kind of my pitch. Four generations of a family. And then I also have, around the same time, The Best of World SF Volume 3, which is a big anthology of international science fiction stories from around the world. And it's the third one in the series. So that's just this year. And then next year I'll have another historical epic coming out over here, which I'm hoping to finish soon. And, you know, probably a bunch of other things, but I don't know. I do have that children's book that I'm very excited about coming out next year as well. But
wow, that's amazing.
Lavi, your energy. You know, I'm 500 words a day and you're bringing out four books a year. I bow to you.
I think it was just a target. I mean, I don't know. I'm very lazy. I mean, I do almost nothing. You know, I mostly watch television. I think it's more because I get bored easily, so I just keep doing different things. And that's why it looks like I'm prolific. Just think, writing is 99% doing nothing.
Thank you to Lavi Tidar for being the subject of our September interview. As always, we'll post links in our show notes so you can find out more about Lavi and his work. We're always delighted to read your contributions. So if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write On Audio. Write On Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for Pen to Print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.